So Margaret, we're going to put 100 liters in here.
This is going to be a mountain style of cheese.
Oh, and this one's going to be a direct acid.
I'm standing in the basement of a large single-family home in BC's Cowichan Valley. The basement has been converted into a small but modern cheesemaking facility.
So, two different ways of making mozzarella today. One a little more fast, quite a bit faster, where we just sour the milk quickly. And now we work with our normal curd recipe.
This is where Hillary and Patty Abbott make their artisan cheeses, and where they've invited other area cheesemakers and a cheesemaking consultant to help them better their products.
You're pressing underway.
Right, pressing underway, no air. In fact, the way they really make this is in kettles. And at this point, they slide a coarse cheesecloth underneath the curd, and they pull the whole thing out in a big mass and drop it in, and they make one wheel.
Peter Dixon has been making cheese for more than 20 years. While based in Vermont, he's traveled around the world to help people launch or improve cheese operations. He mostly travels in North America now, where he says the craft of making superior cheeses has only been in resurgence for the past 35 years.
The kind of people that have gotten into cheese making since the 70s, they're relative novices of it. There's a handful that are multi-generational, but many of those, unfortunately, during the heavily industrialization of the food production in this North America after the Second World War, many of them had to go out of business. And you look at Wisconsin, for example, the state of Wisconsin, they used to have cheese making factories or creameries, if you want to call them that, pretty much in every area where there are 20 to 40 dairy farms, and the milk would come from there. And that goes right back to that system I described in the Alps, where they make Comté and Gruyère, where you have a collective type of creamery production of using the milk from the farmers in your village to make your cheese. Well, we kind of we lost that. We didn't kind of lose it. We did lose it.
It didn't take too long for Hillary to soak up some of Peter's knowledge.
Most of my cheese making was purely based on a clock, and Peter taught us to watch the activity that's going on. It is a living organism, and nothing goes by the clock. You work based upon how things are unfolding, and one of them is the setting, the rennet that gets added, and how long it takes for the milk to set up into a coagulum. That first initial time is very critical.
Peter Dixon knows there's much more to cheese making than the day you actually transform milk into curds and whey, so he also inspected Hillary's aging room with Denis Huet, Hillary's affineur, the guy in charge of the aging process.
Yeah, and they feel really nice right now. See, if they could just stay like this for a month or a month and a half or right up until you sell them, it'd be better for the...
In the buckets.
Yeah, it'd be better for the cheese because then the rind wouldn't get so humid. Once you wrap it, even in a good paper, you've got more humidity at the rind.
Yeah. But should I clean that once in a while?
So, you've made the cheese, you've carefully aged it, and it's ready to sell. But what do you call your cheese? Part of being a cheesemaker also lies in the marketing of your product.
And we started with this one, and we were going to call it Billy Blue or something like that. And we wanted Sacre Bleu, but I felt it sounded sacrilegious to use that French and derogatory term. And Denis has been doing market research at the market, checking with his colleagues who speak French. And today, Sacre Bleu is not as derogatory as it once was. So we've conceded, and it's called Sacre Bleu.
You've bitten the bullet.
And Denis...
At one point during the two-day workshop sessions, three or four cheesemakers and a couple of specialty shop owners joined together for a tasting session. I'll let you eavesdrop on part of it. Some of their jargon might be a little hard to follow, but I want you to get the idea of how every part of the process can be up for debate and discussion.
Because pretty much. It's package, basically, and retail it.
The flavor is beautiful.
Eric and I all cut from the piece, but it still has to hold its own shape for a period of time, like a week or 5 days or however long it takes us to go through that wheel. So that's a very tricky situation that This has the consistency in the center to hold it together, but doesn't have the flavor in the center. So by the time the flavor is in the middle, at the way it's going, it might be too...
But that's why I moved it. That's what,
you're doing a different temperature,
which is, we're talking only a few degrees here.
Yeah.
But it does make a huge difference. So
sharing the costs of bringing someone like Peter Dixon to the other side of the continent makes sense for these BC cheesemakers. Most of them have problems keeping up with the demand, so it's not like they're in direct competition. And Hillary thinks Peter will be back.
There's never enough learning that can go on. We now have a colleague that we can keep in touch with, and he knows us, and we hope to have him back again. But certainly we gain lots of new insights, and we're applying them every day we make cheese.
In last week's episode on Parmigiano-Reggiano cheesemaking, I talked about how that process is hundreds of years old. I'd like to think that someday we'll be able to say that about cheeses made here in Canada. We just have to make sure we appreciate all the work that's going into the making of them. That's Food for Thought. I'm Don Genova.
Do you sell any goat blues?
I sell a couple, but more.
I sell a Jacquin one from France. Yeah. It's a triangle. It's quite a dry cheese, actually. Yeah. It's a blue. Right. And it holds together quite nicely.
What's it called?
It's just called...